Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 183 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I want to introduce you to three co-hosts. First is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, he got it right for once. Hey, folks, greetings from hot Philadelphia.
Wow. And I've been practicing, too. Also with us is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Hey, hi from beautiful, snowy Chicago, where it's finally winter, and it's almost, I think we only have 49 days left until spring, but who's counting?
And then we also have Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog.
Hey, good evening, everyone.
As for our guest this episode, well, it appears that we don't have one. We had a guest scheduled. There was a little bit of a snafu with
a scheduling inconsistency.
That's exactly right. And so we'll fly without a guest this episode, but we'll look to reschedule her in the future.
I think we should plan on intricately leveraging our synergies for the remainder of the program.
Let's try that. So coming up, we'll talk about some of the aviation news from the past week. David will provide his This Week in Aviation History segment, including the aircraft of the week. And I think Grant flies solo with the Australia Desk report. He covers a few headlines, an overly accurate mood-sensing music system, and some voicemails. Also this week on Across the Pond, Peter has the monthly news segment with Tim and Gareth. And we have some more Grill the Geeks questions, and we'll close out with a little bit of listener mail. So let's get started with some aviation news. Our first story comes from the Dayton Daily News. Air Force plans to ground Global Hawk plane, stop production, report says. Well, the Global Hawk is built by Northrop Grumman. It's powered by an Allison Rolls-Royce turbofan engine. And it's designed for high-altitude, long-endurance missions. Is that right, David?
Yes, that's correct.
The administration, I guess, has accepted an Air Force recommendation. And instead of continuing to use the Global Hawk UAVs, they're going to use the old U-2 spy plane. David, why would they want to do that?
This is so bizarre. I'm all for manned surveillance, but Richard Abilafia at the bottom of this article actually says, well, the U-2s are paid for. The Global Hawks aren't. I think that's a really dumb reason to use a 50-year-old airframe. Don't get me wrong, I love the U-2, but the Obama administration has decided that they should scrap the aircrafts they've been spending millions of dollars on and continue flying the U-2s where the youngest airframe was created in the late 70s. So this was one of those ones that you read it and you read the headline and you go, no, really? So the Air Force seems to think that the U-2 is far more cost-effective than the Global Hawk. Now, the U-2 has been upgraded with all the Global Hawk surveillance equipment. So in that point, yes, the U-2 is just as functional. And at this point, the man in the U-2 is just to keep the plane aloft. Most of the systems are run electronically from a ground base for the reconnaissance portion of it. However, the Global Hawk has endurances of like 24 hours of sustained flight. And as we change our strategy to a Pacific focused, which is the current buzzwords, the U-2 sure as hell does not have the endurance of a 24-hour surveillance platform. So one of the other articles that came out this week is the Navy is, and we had this on one of our extra episodes, I interviewed Northrop Grumman about BAMS, which is the naval version of the Global Hawk, which is for maritime surveillance. They're thinking that maybe they would like the Air Force to start purchasing the BAMS aircraft instead of their basic Type 30 airframe. So there's more going on than just the overall headline that says the U-2s will keep flying until they're in their late 70s, early 80s. I have started a new mantra as far as the United States Air Force is concerned. Life begins at 50.
Yeah.
I mean, we have C-130s, B-52s. I mean, aircraft are getting to be really, really old, and suddenly they're finding new lives as far as the Air Force is concerned. So clearly the only thing that can replace a U-2 is another U-2.
That would be the U-3, I guess, right?
The U-3. So, David, is this being driven by budgetary issues?
These are going to be decisions that are going to be done because we need to cut $487 billion, that's B, billion, from our defense budget. And there are going to be probably in the next couple of years some even stranger decisions than this. But yeah, this is not a fault of the Global Hawk aircraft. This is the fact that somewhere in the long, somebody decided that it was a perfect line item to strike to save money. Hmm.
Northrop Grumman is no doubt unpleased at this.
Right. And one of the things that Northrop Grumman is really upset about is if the Air Force scraps them, there goes all the foreign sales. This is going to be one of those perfect systems that no one's going to want to buy because the Air Force didn't want it. Case in point, if you go back to the 80s, the Northrop F-20 Tiger Shark, according to Chuck Yeager, was one of the greatest fighter aircraft ever built. Hmm. But since the Air Force didn't buy it, nobody else did. So countries like Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, who are in the process of purchasing Global Hawks, the Germans for NATO, may start rethinking their decision because there's got to be something wrong with it because the Air Force doesn't want it. Hmm.
Interesting. One last question, because I'm curious. The naval version of the Global Hawk, does that take off and land from carriers?
No, it doesn't. It is a maritime-based aircraft. It would perform the mission of a P-3, for example, where it's a land-based takeoff and landing, and so they would not be launching them from carriers. The wingspan's just way too big. You're talking about an aircraft the size of a 727. Global Hawks are not little. We're so used to talking about Reapers and Predators. Global Hawk is in a class by itself. I mean, it's an enormous aircraft. My jaw dropped open when I saw my first one at Pax River. It's a big airplane, and it's just unfortunate that we're going to cancel a program that we've already spent millions of dollars on.
What do these things cost, David? What are they per copy? Do you know?
I don't know.
Yeah, there is a figure in the article, I think.
I mean, that is kind of silly when you think about. Of course, I guess that's the problem with this whole budget issue is that every industry is facing the same situation where someone says, I can't believe they're going to do something this stupid, and then fill in the blank about some program or some product that they're going to cut.
Yeah, Rob, I think you're right. It's happening everywhere, it seems.
Currently, the program, the unit cost is $200 million, which includes one aircraft and a ground control station. Hmm. So, and currently, the program is actually $1.635 billion that we've spent on the program already.
And you can probably buy a lot of U-2 flights for that amount of money.
But you don't, because think about it. The U-2 is a 45 or 50-year-old aircraft. How many man-hours are you going to spend servicing the aircraft on the ground because it is so old? You start talking about man-hours per flight, and if the aircraft is spending 200 man-hours for one flight of 2 hours, when does the cost factor come in?
Well, and let's not forget the fact, too, why do we have these? Because we didn't want to put a man in an airplane and send him somewhere where it was dangerous, right? And we could keep him aloft for, you know, I don't know what a Global Hawk will stay aloft for, 24 hours or something.
Right. Yeah. You can't put a guy in a U-2 for 24 hours. You can put a Global Hawk orbiting a huge spectrum of airspace for 24 hours, consistently returning, and when someone needs to get up and go to the bathroom, he has somebody else sit down at the console and that person goes away or gets lunch or something. Whereas the U-2 guy is stuck in an aircraft that is probably one of the hardest aircraft to fly because the envelope it flies in. if up 2 degrees up, you are flying supersonic. 2 degrees down, you're at stall. It's the YouTube.
Wouldn't it just be the other way around?
It would be the other way around. I apologize. Yeah,
okay.
But that's why you're the pilot and I'm not.
Okay. But, that's all right.
I sit corrected. But that being said, it is one of the hardest aircraft to fly. Let no talk about landing. I mean, the U-2, you need we're going to have to keep continuing purchasing Corvettes and 2000. I mean, for every time you need a landing, you need an aircraft to chase after it to talk the pilot to the ground. So what we're going to find out is, I jokingly have told everybody, is the reason why the U-2 is doing it is because we already have a manned replacement that could do what the Global Hawk does. It's just out at Area 51 and no one knows about it yet.
Okay.
How many Global Hawks do we have? Do you know? I'm sorry, maybe I'm asking really dopey questions, but...
It's probably a secret.
No.
No?
Well, it is probably, but they'll tell me. Because I'm not much of a threat to anybody.
NASA has one, and Germany has two, and it looks like the Air Force has at least 25.
Wow.
So 25 times 200 million apiece.
I'm sorry. The Air Force, as of last year, they reduced the Block 40s to 11. So we've got 12 of them, say, and they're going to cancel them all.
Well, when you say they're going to cancel them all, I mean, does that mean they're going to take them out of service or they're just not going to buy anymore?
Yes, they're taking them out of service and they are not buying anymore.
Okay, so we're going to save money by throwing $2.5 billion in the garbage can.
Yeah, exactly.
I see. Okay.
This is one of those stories that we are going to see over the next couple of years where people are going to go, okay, I'm going to use a term Dan would love. Who did the cost-benefit analysis on this decision?
That sounds like that could be a really bad, like, sitcom catchphrase.
I think.
What, CBAs?
Yes.
All right, I think we should push on to our next topic. Next story comes from Aviation Pros. This is push for third Chicago airport still aloft. I guess in the last 5 years, according to this article, the number of people flying in and out of the nine main airports in Illinois, that's decreased more than 10%. So what are the officials doing in the state that Rob Mark calls home? Why, they want to build a third airport at Chicago. Rob, what's up with that?
Well, of course, the fact that they want to name it after me is absolutely not true. I just thought we better start with that fact.
Mark International?
It's not true. Actually, this airport is down near the south side, far south side of Chicago, near the Piatone VOR, Echo Oscar November, for those of you tracking that sort of thing. But the Piatone Airport was supposed to be Chicago's third airport, except that it has been a political nightmare because there's no funding for it, and some of the politicians that want it seem to want it because it will bring a lot of jobs to build the airport, which of course it will. But none of the airlines want to go there because they're already stressed out in this economy, maintaining operations sometimes split between O'Hare and Midway, and they just do not want to go to a third airport. They don't believe the business model is there, but of course, the politicians don't really care about that anyway.
Yeah.
So this has been, again, one of those situations that it's been going on for, I don't know, almost 20 years, I'd say. And they purchased land, but they never actually did anything else with it down there.
But what's the... Okay, here's my turn to get revenge on you. What's the point? I mean, who did they think were going to... Was it to overflow O'Hare or was it to overflow Midway? Why would you want another airport south of the city?
Well, and that's a good question, Dave. And I mean, the people at Midway don't really think that they're that jam-packed. I mean, that they can't handle anymore. Now, of course, I grant you a few years down the line, maybe that will be a different story. But they still do not believe that enough people from the South Side and the South Suburbs of Chicago travel by air that will drive down to Piatone rather than go to Midway. And so, again, it's been a pie in the sky project for a couple of different governors, but nobody else seems to care.
So Rob, I really don't know Illinois geography or airports that well. But at the same time, isn't Rockford trying to build up service right now? Are they really a viable alternative?
Well, it's an interesting point that you make, because Rockford is about, if we look at O'Hare as the central point, it's about 50 or 60 miles to the west-northwest of O'Hare. And Rockford right now is trying to build its cargo capabilities. UPS already has a fairly significant hub out at Rockford. And so there are some occasional passenger flights. Allegiant goes in there to, Dan, you'd probably know better than I would. They probably go to Florida and they probably go to Vegas or something. But there's not a lot of passenger traffic there.
Yeah, though they did just get a Frontier to come in.
Oh, did they really? Oh, okay. Yes. Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. And the Piatone Airport would be just about as far to the south of O'Hare as Rockford is to the northwest. And so, again, the major airlines don't want to put anything at Rockford either.
All right, follow-up question. Hasn't Gary, Indiana, been trying this at the same time? So where are they in relation to Piatone?
Well, Gary, of course, has never quite recovered from losing their Hooters.
What?
And
Hooters Air, rest in peace. They were.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sorry.
Wasn't it Pace Airlines that operated that?
Yeah, it was, but it said Hooters on the side. And I'm sorry. Did you guys misunderstand what I said?
No, of course not. Of course not.
Oh, I hope not. yeah. But and Gary's another funny place. I mean, it has a long runway, but it is so close to Midway that. Same thing. People that are in that area say, well, why would I go to Gary for one or two flights a day, which is all that most of the airlines that have tried to start there can generate? Or I'll just drive over to Midway and there's probably, 200 flights a day on Southwest to just about anywhere or Delta. And so Gary's just never been able to generate enough energy flight wise to be of any use to anybody.
Yeah, so I guess I just wonder if Rockford and Gary haven't been able to make a really successful run at it, why do we need a third airport?
Well, and again, I think actually Rockford is going to have a better chance than Gary ever will. And again, Rockford has, I worked out there 20 some years ago and we didn't have the UPS hub out there then. And now, I mean, they've lengthened the runways. They've added lots of concrete. There are lots of big airplanes in and out of there buying a lot of fuel. And so the town of Rockford, the city of Rockford, is very happy about that. And they'd like to expand that cargo capability. But Gary, that's not going to happen. I mean, and of course, the last mayor we had in Chicago, Mayor Daley, was so against the Piatone Airport that they made some kind of a deal with the Gary people. And that's how Gary was called, I think it's called Chicago Gary Regional or something like that. But that was because of the handshake deal with the mayor of Chicago, so they didn't have to deal with Piatone.
So, Rob, if this thing does go forward, are you all set, ready to jump in with your new media expertise to help them get this thing established?
Yeah, that'll, of course, be Piatone. I have to see if that's available. Piatone Airport on Twitter. Can I do that while I'm doing the show?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool.
All right. Let's go on to our next story. This comes from the Washington Post. Turns out that U.S. airline consolidation talk continues. The article in the Post says, Delta said to weigh U.S. Airways bid in review of M&A options. M&A, of course, being merger and acquisition. So apparently people are saying that Delta Airlines Inc. is considering a bid for U.S. Airways Group. And this is from unnamed people, and there may not even have been discussions amongst the parties involved. But I don't know. Would this be something that would make sense?
Well, stories like this, I have a love-hate relationship with, because it's all, you know, unnamed sources. Not there's anything wrong with that, but there, it's a lot of, you know, not of a lot of hard details. But on the other hand, I love them because it's just so fun to think about airline mergers. I am such a geek. So what's interesting is we've seen there have been rumors and reports for a while that both Delta and U.S. Airways were somewhat interested in American, especially now that they're in Chapter 11. U.S. Airways, they confirmed that during their recent quarterly earnings call. But now we see this rumor that Delta and Delta's looking at U.S. Airways, which is – it's very interesting because U.S. Airways – their management team has, if you look over the past few years, been a very strong advocate for consolidation and has tried to participate in it beyond the U.S. Airways America West merger a few years ago. If you remember back when Delta was in Chapter 11, U.S. Airways was making a move to make a bid there, and then we had the whole Keep Delta, My Delta campaign, and Delta stayed independent. And then also... a couple of years ago, there's a bunch of media coverage about how, there's a potential of a U.S. Airways United tie-up, which actually had been attempted over 10 years ago now, but then United ended up merging with Continental. So, you know, it's fun to consider it, especially how the networks would mesh. So, for example, you know, Delta and American use JFK to move traffic. That's their East Coast hub to move traffic to Europe, and U.S. Airways uses Philly for that. It's varying how the two hubs work together, though. I kind of wonder how it would work on an alliance side, because it actually might be a little bit cleaner for U.S. Airways and Delta if that were to happen, because while Delta's in SkyTeam and U.S. Airways is in Star Alliance, I don't believe U.S. Airways is in the Star Alliance transatlantic joint venture that is antitrust immunity. Whereas if we saw something with Delta and American, Delta's in a antitrust immunity agreement with Air France KLM and Alitalia, I believe. And whereas American is tied up with British Airways and Iberia. So if you saw some kind of merger there, that would that could get a little cool, interesting to see how that. I'm sorry for saying interesting, but it would just be that would just it would just be fun to see how that would work out. The other concern, though, in my mind, is what happens on a regulatory side in terms of antitrust concerns. I mean, granted, the past few mergers have gotten through pretty easily. United Continental got through, and the really only big divestiture there where they had to give up some Newark slots up, and those ended up with Southwest. Though, I mean, there is precedent. I mean, just like I said, the U.S. Airways United deal from over 10 years ago was shut down because of antitrust concerns. So, you know, for example, if you were to have Delta American, you know, both airlines have a key focus on New York City. And with post-slot swap, once all those slots change hands over the next few months, Delta will have, I think, 45%-ish of the total slot holdings at LaGuardia, and I think American has about 20 or so. I forget the exact number. So the government may require some divestitures there. So, you know, this is all, you know, very early, all very speculative reporting. But, you know, we could be seeing a round three, so to speak, of big consolidation here, and end up with only three major legacy airlines. But who knows what will happen? I mean, Chapter 11 in American's case, Chapter 11. You know, you always see, you know, Chapter 11 always has a lot of unanswered questions, and this U.S. Airways Delta thing is kind of brand new. So we'll just have to. This is stuff where it's fun to be an outside observer, and you get to see how it all plays out.
Yeah, and I suspect we'll be having some fun with this one for probably quite a while. Even if it goes through, even if it doesn't go through.
Yeah. Either way, the American Chapter 11 filing, which will take a while to sort itself out, if they stay independent, will have plenty of interesting details.
Okay, let's go on to our fourth story. This is also from Aviation Pros. This is delays worse after JFK runway work done. Well, according to this article, they've spent $376 million on a runway reconstruction project that was supposed to reduce flight delays. The article says, but since the runway reopened in July 2010, the percentage of late arrivals and departures has increased. Well, sort of. My read of this says arrival delays went from 19% to 20%, and departure delays went from 18% to 19%, which sounds kind of statistically flat to me, so I'm not sure I would call it an increase, but it's not an improvement. So what do we think happened here? Did they just waste $376 million?
It's kind of hard to interpret sometimes. So a few things. What I didn't like about this article was it talks about how this project was promised to reduce. They didn't say, well, the cutting the time planes spent traveling to and from the gate by up to a minute. So it would reduce taxi times, which is a completely valid thing to measure. But then they go and look at arrival delays and departure delays. Now, the problem with this is that I don't think that's necessarily the right statistics to be using here. It is for arrival delays because, you know, the taxi out because basically that is arrival delays is measured for when the aircraft comes into the gate. So taxi times affect that. But for departure delays, it's from when the aircraft is leaving the gate. So taxi out times out to the runway, that isn't even in the departure delay calculation. And that saved taxi time, if anything, would be reflected in the arrival time at the airport that the flight is, you know, the flight is leaving JFK. And if it has a shorter taxi time, it could arrive perhaps a minute sooner at the destination airport. So that's why I don't think it's the best measure. And I actually played around with the DOT operational data, which has taxi times. And in 5 of those 6 months, they used October through March 2010 and October 2010 through March 2011. If you compare those 6 months to the next 6 months, in 5 of those 6 months, taxi in times were shorter. And in 4 of those 6 months, taxi out times were shorter. But I actually, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of even putting out numbers like that for a couple reasons. The first thing is that while the DOT data set is really great, and I really enjoy playing around with it, it does have a couple weaknesses. But one of the issues with this data set, it's very powerful, but some carriers don't report. So some of the smaller regional carriers aren't included, and what's especially important for major airport like JFK, international data is included. So for July 2011, if we exclude cargo carriers, for example, I'm estimating about maybe 35% of flights aren't in this DOT database. That number could be different for those earlier time periods because the carriers that were reporting to DOT have changed over time. But it just goes to show, you know, you have a bunch of flights, especially at JFK when it's really congested in the late afternoon, early evening, when you have a bunch of international departures. You know, that isn't even being factored in here. And the other issue, of course, is while, you know, there's lots of stuff we can do with airport infrastructure and the carriers can do, and, you know, next gen over the next coming years, hopefully will continue to improve airlines' abilities to operate in tougher weather conditions. You know, weather, you know, summer thunderstorms and major winter storms are going to screw up airline operations. So an issue that you have here, if you compare 2 6-month periods, you know, you can do that, but I sometimes get concerned doing that because, you know, there, if, for example, if you're tracking departure delays and not just looking at taxi out times, but just departure delays period, if you're comparing one July to another and one July from 1 year had there were a bunch of thunderstorms that were really bad and the ramp had to close for safety reasons, well, that's not really a fair comparison. So that's where I think you have to be very careful when you look at airline operational data on a very high level like this. You have to be concerned about what else could be going on and be absolutely sure that you're making fair comparisons. So, you know, I didn't look at this data a whole bunch to get really down the details, but I think this article might be a little bit unfair because, you know, there are a bunch of departure delays. You know, looking at just departure and arrival delays, you know, it's certainly you want to see if a project was effective, but there are so many other things going on that could be affecting delays that are independent of the runway that it may not be a fair comparison.
And now with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 4, Episode Number 5, January 29th through February 4th. Somebody please tell me where the heck January went. January 30th, 1943, a mix of Halifax and Sterling bombers take off for a night attack on Hamburg, Germany. The 13 bombers are equipped with H-2S ground mapping radar. The H-2S enabled the bombers to fly at night using landmarks to navigate their way to the target. The H-2S was a radar dish located in the belly of the bombers. The reason this was so important was because up until H-2S, the Air Force chose to bomb at night, and they were not able to use pinpoint targets but relied on area bombing. The H-2S gave them the ability to see at night. On that first mission, bombs were not dropped by the 7 attackers, 6 were returned to base, but incendiaries. They lit Hamburg for a follow-on by attack by 100 Lancaster bombers. Of a side note, the H-2S continued to be used and developed by Great Britain and was used through the V-bombers, and its final battle was the Falkland War by Black Buck Vulcan bombers. February 1st, 1983, 19 years after entering service with Eastern Airlines, Boeing announced it would stop producing the 727 Trijet. The 727 was designed to operate on short-haul routes with 149 passengers. Interestingly, the 727 was a compromise. It was the best way for Boeing to meet three requirements. Satisfy Eastern's need to fly to a Caribbean destination. American wanted a more efficient airline, Atlanta airliner, and United wanted to fly into Stapleton Airport in Denver. Between 1963 and 1984, when production ended, there was 1,831 727s produced. As of this morning, there are still 160 on the FAA registry, though most are freighters. Lastly, there were 4 C-22s built for the United States Air Force for transport purposes. February 4th, 1902, Robert Falcon Scott and Sir Ernest Shackleton climb into the basket of a tethered hydrogen-fueled bag. The balloon attained a height of 735 feet. The mission was to take aerial photographs of the Antarctic continent. The completed flight became the first balloon flight in Antarctica. The aircraft of the week, the Curtiss Robin. However, there's a corollary. The writer of this segment reserves the right to occasionally call an audible. We'll be doing the Lockheed L-10 Electra. Designed to compete for airline business against the Boeing 247 and the Douglas DC-2, the Lockheed L-10 was first flown on February 23, 1934. The design by Hall Hibbard originally featured one tail. Like all Lockheed aircraft, the aircraft was to be named after a star or a constellation. Sometimes take a look at the original Lockheed logo. In this case, it's a star in the Pleiades, or the Seven Sisters for us amateur astronomers. The L-10 became the Electra. The Electra was a follow-on to the successful Orion and Vega aircraft, which were known for their streamlining. The L-10 was to be Lockheed's first twin-engined all-metal aircraft. A model of the aircraft was sent to the University of Michigan, where a young engineer worked in the wind tunnel there. This engineer eventually suggested that the single vertical tail surface be replaced by twin tails. This suggestion would get that engineering student a job with Lockheed and become one of his most famous signature design features. The grad student was Clarence Kelly Johnson, who would eventually become a god in the Parthenon of aircraft designers. But back to the L-10. H.T. Dick Merrill used the L-10 to make the first round-trip crossing of the Atlantic in May of 1937. Interestingly enough, his cargo was newsreel footage of the Hindenburg disaster at Lakehurst, New Jersey. Of the 149 Electras built, the most famous was the Model 10E NR November Romeo 16020, which was Amelia Earhart's. The 10E was equipped with a pair of Pratt Whitney R1340 Wasps and was financed by Purdue University. The 10E was bought and modified to Earhart's specifications. The fuselage windows were removed and streamed over. The interior was replaced with a large fuel tank. Earhart dubbed the aircraft the Flying Laboratory, and it was cursed from the beginning. Earhart's around-the-world flight actually was started twice. The first attempt ended in Hawaii. The flight to the islands from Burbank ended due to a failure of the variable pitch props. 3 days later, Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan ground-looped the aircraft upon takeoff. The aircraft, with its broken landing gear, was packed up and shipped back to Lockheed by ship. The second flight was begun by an unannounced cross-country from Oakland to Miami. It was then decided to fly the round-the-world flight from west to east. On July 2, 1937, November Romeo 16020 disappeared with its crew of two. The Electra has completed actually two around-world flights since the missing L-10E disappeared. An L-10A was flown by Ann Pellegrino with a crew of four, completed the trip on the 30th anniversary of Amelia's flight. On the 60th anniversary of Amelia's flight, Linda Finch flew an actual L-10E, the exact model that Earhart flew around the world. The L-10 also flew for the United States Army Air Corps in World War II as the C-35 and C-36. It had two variants, the L-12 Electra Junior, which was an 8-seat version, and the 14-seat L-14 Super Electra. The Super Electra would lead to the Hudson Bomber of Royal Air Force fame. The L-10 clearly is a very historic aircraft. So, for next week, we'll run the randomizer. And the winner is the Super Marine Attacker, a Royal Navy aircraft that was a carrier-based aircraft with a tailwheel and a jet engine. Or I'll give the option to our listeners for the Curtis Robin. So this week, I'll post up to a Facebook a survey to decide which one we're going to do next week. So the choice will be the Supermarine Attacker or the Curtis Robin. And you guys decide and pick the choice. So that's the way it was, January 29th through February 4th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
All right. Thank you, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Well, here I am in the studio waiting for Steve. I wonder where he is. Oh, well, it's January 29th, 2012. Doesn't feel right doing this without Steve. Oh, wait, he'll be around soon enough. I've put together a really cool system that's going to detect what the ambient mood is in the room, and it'll play the right music to fit the space. Let's give it a whirl. Right. Not so sure about that one. What else to do? I know. I can flick through and prepare the headlines for when Steve gets here and we can go through it. Oh, let's see. What's up? Oh, yeah. Definitely first up has to be the latest rumor about Malaysian Airlines and Qantas probably going to do a premium airline. Yeah, rumor. This time, the Malaysian daily newspaper The Star reported back on Friday that apparently way back on Tuesday, the two airlines were very close on signing an initial agreement to set up the premium airline joint venture. However, this initial agreement has apparently been pushed back indefinitely. Yeah, I think we knew that was coming. I just don't know. There's a lot of rumors going around. I just don't think it's going to happen. But still, we should bring that one up first. I'll see what Steve says. What's the next one? The ACCC says AirAsia X breached the law with its displayed pricing of tickets. Australia's consumer watchdog has filed legal action against AirAsia X, saying they failed to disclose the full price of international flights from Australia. Well, that should get Dan's attention. Mate, down here in Australia, you've got to display the full price. You can't go into a store and have a ticket price on an item and then be told, oh, plus tax, it's got to be in the final price. And that also applies for airlines and especially with all their fees. Interesting to see what happens there. Maybe we should point out to AirAsia X what happened to Tiger when Tiger Airways tried to take on the ACCC and only implement those parts of Australian consumer law that it thought suited it. We'll see what happens with AirAsia X. What else? Oh, yeah, the A380 cracks. I'm sure Steve's going to enjoy chatting about this one. Airbus has confirmed that the cracks are occurring because the wrong kind of alloy has been used, and the process for attaching the ribs, skin, and fasteners all together has actually aggravated things and made the cracks occur. Looks like they're going to have to redesign these fasteners, which will add about 89 kilos to the total weight of an A380, which isn't that much when you think about it, but still every kilo counts in the airlines. But definitely all these have to be replaced over time with the existing ones and will be changed on the new ones. But it's not something that's required right this instant. It's something that can be done during the next major maintenance period. Blackhawks. Yeah, that's a good one. Blackhawks. Always good to have our helicopters flying again. Turns out that it was a batch of faulty bolts. Once they isolated it down to those, they could put them aside, and on we go. The Blackhawks are flying again, just in time to provide flood relief for New South Wales, where once again the northern central area of New South Wales is flooding. So always good to have the helicopters available for that. I think that's about it. I think that's about enough of it. Still no Steve. Wonder where it could be. Let's try this music again. Maybe it's onto something cooler now that we've had a bit of upbeat reading of the news. Yeah, let's see what's on. No, I think we'll pass on that. I think it's time I called Steve to find out where he's at.
Hey, everyone's Steve, and I'm not in the studio for a change. I'm free, I'm on the run. Leave me a message, and this is Hugh Grant. I'll call you back, trust me.
Yeah, right. Thanks, mate. You know, Anthony's probably in the country again. Let's give him a whirl. Haha, if Steve's not going to show up, I bet you Anthony can help. Let's try his number.
Hi, you've called Anthony Simmons, the infrequent flyer. I'm currently sampling the Degas Station Board on EK Flight 062 from Hamburg to Dubai, and I can't take your call. But this is important to me, so please leave your name, number, and a brief message, and I'll get back to you as soon as I'm in a fit state to be able to operate the phone again. Yeah, thanks. The quail's eggs and the botrytis. Brilliant.
Oh, you lucky bugger. Well, okay, not him. What about Baz? Yeah, Baz could be around. It's 5:30 yesterday over in Adelaide. Let's try him.
Hey, it's Baz. I can't take your call right now because I just got into the sporty to pop over to Aldinga for some of Gaining's famous brownies and ice cream. They're delicious. Anyway, catch me on 12715 or leave me a message.
Oh, bloody hell. Everyone's away. Oh, I know someone will be around. Ben, ATC Ben. He's got to be around. He'll probably be working soon. Let's try him.
Hi, you've reached Ben.
4320, direct breakfast.
Look, I told you to stand by.
550, 550, uniform.
Look, you're just going to have to leave a message.
Today, 678.
I'm busy directing air traffic at the moment. I'm going to have to direct you to leave a message.
Oops. Okay, I think we'll let him get back to work. Right. Well, I guess if there's no one around, I should, I can just sit here and play some more music.
In my hour of need, I truly am indeed alone again, naturally.
Right, I think this music system's out to get me. I think it's time for me to go. I'll just leave this playing and send it off to Max. Well, folks, I'm still Grant McCarran, and hopefully I won't be alone next time.
I'm so lonely, so lonely, so lonely and sadly alone. There's no one, just me only, sitting on my rental phone.
Thanks, Grant, and we'll look forward to Steve's return next week. Okay, now here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson, editor of Aerospace International, and Gareth Stringer, deputy editor of Global Aviation Resources. Welcome to Across the Pond.
Hi there. Great to be back.
Good afternoon. Hello.
We're going to have another look back over some of the news items that have come out this month. Lots to talk about. Tim, do you want to start us off with the new UCAV demonstrator that's just been rolled out?
Sure. It's the Dassault-led Neuron unmanned combat air vehicle demonstrator. It's a pan-European UAV, but this one's going to drop bombs. This is a dedicated stealth unmanned aircraft. It's got French leadership. The Greeks are involved. The Italians are on board. So it's a pretty big sort of international project.
And when can we expect to see that flying?
Well, they've got a first flight scheduled in for mid-2012. So, that'll be one to watch. And it's going to be an interesting year for European UCAVs because hopefully the BAE Systems Taranis will also be flying this year.
Yeah.
So interesting stuff. It's the next European technology combat aircraft, but it's also industrially quite significant because what happens then? Can Europe support two competing combat UCAV programs?
Yeah, this sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Will it end up like Rafale, Typhoon, Gripen all over again? Or will these projects have to be merged? I mean, the Neuron, although it has part of EADS Spain, EADS Germany, they've got their own UCAV project in terms of the kind of the Barracuda. So the Germans are still kind of not got a seat at the table. So it's definitely interesting and one to watch.
Tim, am I right in saying that this is going to be a technology demonstrator, and at the moment there aren't any plans for this to become a sort of full production vehicle? Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a technology demonstrator, the same as Taranis is. It has got weapon bays, so they are talking about sort of weapon drops, weapon tests. But it is a technology demonstrator.
Okay,
I suppose going from the sublime to the ridiculous, we've got the RAF going back in time to buy Whisper Jets 146s. it just sounds crazy. This we're getting rid of all of our Hercules, selling off our Harriers, yet we're going out and buying second-hand 146s from the scrap heap. I mean, this just doesn't feel right.
It doesn't sound right, but I think it's a really, really sensible decision. And I think that if you speak to a lot of people who've been involved with operating the aircraft, which we have done for quite some time now, probably a few people that would think we could have done with more of these. We should have done this a while ago because they are incredibly versatile.
Yeah.
It's not a new aircraft, but it is a very, very versatile aircraft that they can operate into theatre, into Afghanistan. And it's not a Hercules, and that's this is what I think is an important thing where sometimes we do go wrong with our procurement. Let's not try and make this into something it isn't. There are lots and lots of jobs it can do, but it isn't a Hercules. I guess they need them, and I'm sure they'll do good work.
Great for the airplane geeks. We get to see 146s back.
Absolutely. I mean,
hopefully they won't, the procurement won't be bodged by adding, too much defensive aids, secure comms, all the rest of it, that'll, turn it into a kind of a over budget and over scheduled, just for what is wanted. But, a Stoll airlifter does hot and high very well.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Moving us swiftly along, apart from wings hauling off our Airbuses, Europe is becoming even more unpopular by the introduction of the emissions trading system. I don't think there's a part in the world that particularly is happy with that. But our own airlines, Ryanair and Lufthansa, have come out and said that they're going to pass any charges on to their passengers. I mean, this just isn't getting any better, is it?
A lot of opposition to that. I mean, from around the world. The thing with ETS is it's somehow managed to unite China and the US.
and India.
Against Europe, which is quite something. So I think you'll see more of this in terms of airlines adding the charges on it. But interestingly, also, that the last month, I've also seen Air Asia X pull out of London flights and Paris flights.
Yeah.
Now, they're a long-haul, low-cost operator from Malaysia, and they sort of said, it's due to ETS, you have to wonder whether, is that really the case, or is it just a case of, long-haul, low-cost, they can't make it work? But it's interesting that they have sort of specified that and said, you know, it's ETS. And if it is putting people off that paying that extra to travel long haul, then, you know, that is sort of significant.
And do we think this will push more and more airlines away from hubs like Heathrow down to Dubai in the Middle East?
Difficult to say, really. It's not helping. I mean, there's Air China as well that's also taken a service out in the past week. So it's only got a sort of benefit, you know, benefit us kind of avoiding Europe, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And some people also sort of say that if you're trying to route round Europe, i.e. to get round it, it ends up with some airlines we're ending up burning more CO2.
Yeah, crazy times. And nothing crazier than London Mayor Boris Johnson wanting to put an airport on the River Thames.
Boris Island, as I saw it. christened in the mail this week.
Yeah,
I have to say I'm a bit bemused by all of this because it does seem to go against a lot of what's being said.
And
when I saw this news in the week, it was just almost a little bit like, you know, what on earth is going on?
Yeah, it's a 180 degree turnaround on the government's policy of no expansion in southeast. But
well, it's not quite what was ruled out by the government was expansion of Heathrow. That's the sort of real problem that people are trying to kind of think, you know, sort of laterally around. And there is something to be said for the Thames estuary location, because what you're doing is you're removing from it the whole thing that has constrained airport expansion since, you know, 50s or even before. They're looking for these big infrastructure projects. There's a whole thing of the housing market has completely died. They want to look at what can generate jobs, right?
Yeah.
Big kind of project like this. So it has got benefits, but the thing is, we may all already be too late. You know, Heathrow has got such a capacity, you know, 99% operating capacity, that unless you go for sort of a crash program, for example, like Hong Kong, as quick as possible, you're not really going to sort of solve the problem. It may already be too late. You've got to have something to kind of alleviate the capacity crunch, the traffic, the amount of growth there is already while building this new airport.
Well, on that note, we'll leave it there. Tim, where can we find you online?
The Royal Aeronautical Society's website is www.aerosociety.com, and you can find me on Twitter at @RAESTimR.
And Gareth?
You can find Global Aviation Resource at www.globalaviationresource.com, and I'm on Twitter as Gareth_Stringer.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Across the Pond from the Airplane Geeks. Aviation with just a dash of culture.
All right. Again, time for Grill the Geeks. This is where listeners ask us questions and we see if we can come up with the answers.
Oh, God. Do we have to do the Grill the Geeks segment again?
Oh, it's David, really, don't be such a whiner. Come on. What's the big deal?
Well, because, you know, let's face it. It's become Grill the Geek segment, and I'm the one that always seems to be getting all the questions.
So what's your problem?
It ain't fair, and I'm tired of it.
No, I think, you know, guys, I think David has a point, and we should, listeners, hello, could you guys help us out? I really want to see Grill the Geek stay around, and we can't make David do all the work. Somebody needs to take pot shots at, you know, Max and Dan and me.
Let's share the pain a little bit.
Yeah, let's share the pain. Come on, don't be such babies. Don't take all the easy questions and throw them at David. We're feeling very insecure here.
All right, I think that's a great idea. So listeners, let's kind of shift them a little bit more away from David and towards the other three of us, just to sort of balance it out. So if you do that, we'd really appreciate it.
Now, that's the nice way of saying it.
Yeah. Now the Rob Mark way of saying it is,
yeah, come on, we have got to give David a little break. Come on, his brain is just melting down from doing all the work on Grill the Geeks every week. We need Dan and myself and Max to get some of the questions. We need some of the love, don't we, guys?
Yeah.
I'm feeling left out. Dan, how well Dan always feels left out. Never mind. Dan's on mute.
Dan's on mute. Let's see. Here's one from John. John writes, which World War II bomber's airframe was made uniquely of bonded plywood, no metal?
I think it was the Mosquito.
And that's correct. The de Havilland Mosquito. Very good, Rob.
Oh, sorry, I'm not supposed to do that.
All right.
That's kind of like making them feel bad because we got it right, isn't it? Sorry, so let's just strike that silliness from this geeks episode.
Okay, here's another one. Let's see. We got a couple from Michael. Let's see. Michael's first question is, of all the legacy airlines based in the U.S., which one has never had a fatal aircraft accident? Of all the legacy airlines.
Okay, well, it's not U.S. Airways. It's not Alaska. It's not...
It's
not United or American.
And it sure isn't Delta.
Yeah. Hawaiian, the only exact thing I can think is that decompression, but someone died in there. Yeah, no, there was that decompression 737-200 and someone died there.
Yeah, because somebody got sucked out of the airplane.
Yeah, so I guess by process of elimination, if we said major legacy carriers?
Well, he didn't say major. He just said legacy airlines. And maybe he's incorrect because he says the answer is Hawaiian Airlines.
I'm going to look this up right now.
I don't remember anyone getting sucked out of that airframe.
I didn't either. I thought that there were no casualties there.
You know what? I wonder if I'm thinking of that because that was around the same time that.
That was Aloha. That was Aloha, wasn't it?
Oh, you know, you're right. You are right, Daniel. That was Aloha that had the fuselage peel back. But I still think David's right, and Max. I think I'm thinking of the United accident when the 7-4. Split open and somebody got sucked out of the right side of the fuselage.
Oh, yeah, someone got sucked out of that one, and that was over Hawaii, too. But I didn't think they lost anybody on the 737.
Let's look. I'm looking that up. I already feel bad that I missed that. Aloha Airlines Flight 243. Fatalities, one.
Oh.
Yeah, apparently, according to Wikipedia,
So what do we do when a listener gives us a question and the wrong answer and they're do you think
no that, he gave us the right answer so
he did
yes he said it was Hawaiian I forgot about Aloha since they don't do passenger service anymore.
Oh yeah, so strike that last comment.
All right, well, John asked a couple of other quickies. This could be, let's stick with John's questions just for a moment. His other question is this. This aviation university held certificate number one from the FAA for a certified flight school until the school moved locations in the 1990s. What was that school?
Rob, this is all you.
Give me the question one more time.
Okay. This aviation university held certificate number one from the FAA for a certified flight school until the school moved locations in the 1990s.
Wow. Flight school number one.
Yeah. Which university?
Boy, I don't have any idea. I don't have any idea.
Can you at least throw out one guess?
Because
my gut says Purdue, but I have no idea if that's right. Though I don't know if they ever moved.
No, Purdue didn't move. And
Ohio State.
Oh, was it not Ohio State? The Ohio State. Remember, Martin would be very upset.
That's right. We learned that from Martin.
No, is that what it was, the Ohio State?
No, I'll give you the answer. It's C. John,
is it UMD?
John says it's Parks College at St. Louis University.
Oh, darn right. Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
All right.
Give that man a button. Do we have his address?
Yes, we do. Let's just do one. He has a third one for kind of for David, so let's do this since we're on a roll here. It says, this fighter, when at high speeds, begins to yaw due to the rudder's movement. What is that fighter? And here's a hint. It's still in production. and flown by the U.S. military.
David's going to his happy zen place right now.
Well, hold on.
This fighter, when at high speeds, begins to yaw due to the rudder's movement.
I'm going to say F-16.
He says the F-15 Eagle.
He had me on. When he said rudder. I was thinking, oh, well, he wins. Because when he said rudder, I was trying to think of there's more than one rudder on an F-15.
Yeah, well, he said to the begins to yaw due to the rudder's movement. And I don't know if he was meaning, you know.
Well, where was his apostrophe?
There is no apostrophe, but.
Well.
But let's not go. We're not going to get picky about punctuation, right?
That's actually my one of my least favorite things about Rhode Island. No one can use apostrophes here. No one.
All right. Well, you'll have to straighten out Rhode Island. Okay, let's move on to some listener mail. Let's see. First up. Stephen Bennett posted kind of a question and a link on our Facebook page about crosswind landings. He posted a link to a YouTube video that showed a series of crosswind landings during a storm at Dusseldorf, and asked if how pilots handle this situation. And a number of folks replied to the post. But Rob, maybe you can kind of summarize or give your observations about or experience about crosswind landings.
No.
No? Okay. Moving on to the next.
No, it's funny. I did see some, I think we had Carlene jump in there and Chris Mono came in, and I also put up a link to the video of the A380 landing at Air Venture in 2009, because it kind of demonstrated just what we were talking about, that you basically point the airplane into the wind and you kind of fly crooked all the way down final approach, and just before you get down close to the runway, you kick the rudder that's sort of on the opposite side from where the wind is to straighten out the nose, and then you land on the one gear at a time, the one that's closest into the wind, because that's the only way you can keep the airplane going straight down the runway. Some of these big airplanes can land somewhat sideways. And if you've ever seen the Boeing demonstration, I think it was the 777, when they put it out in some kind of hellacious crosswind, and they landed it sideways, and the gear takes it. Mm. But those are unusual situations. I mean, that is just to test how much the airplane will take. It's not considered a normal situation. But again, crosswinds, you know, the point is you've got to straighten out the nose of the airplane before you touch down, and you've got to keep it from drifting, which is what the wind would try to do, which is push you across the runway, or you'll tear the gear off. And that doesn't really make any difference as to whether it's a little airplane, a Cessna 150 or a 727.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, Rob. Is the technique pretty much the same with a small airplane as with a...
Yeah, it really is. The only thing, and I can't remember if it was Chris or Carlene that mentioned it in the Facebook post, but there's a limit to what you can do with a big airplane. You can't drop the wing into the wind too much, because the wings are so long, you run the risk of one of the tips of the wings catching the ground. So that is really what limits the ability of the airplane. How sideways can you land a big airplane without touching the wingtip and wrapping it up into a ball? And so that it gets pretty interesting in big airplanes. Hmm.
Or if you're a B-52 pilot, all you have to do is crab the landing gear.
That's right. Wait, something else had crabbing landing gear.
What do you mean crabbing landing gear?
It's the airplane, we only talk about putting the nose straight because that's the way the wheels point. But if you can get the wheels to point in the direction that is parallel to the runway, but the nose is pointed in another direction, it works fine. And that's what they do in the B-52. You see them pointed into the wind, and they actually land sideways, because in a strong wind, they can make the gear track straight up the runway. So the gear would look like it was on sideways if you saw the airplane.
Yeah. Well, I had no idea. Oh, that's pretty cool.
It was a very top secret thing that Boeing created. But yeah, the B-52 has got two sets of gear parallel, and they can turn them like 18 degrees. So basically the wheels are parallel to the runway and the aircraft looks like it's going down the field diagonally.
Oh, fascinating. And commercial aircraft don't have that feature, I guess.
No, that's true. They don't.
Okay. All right. Next, we got a voicemail from Ian Kershaw. Here's Ian.
Well, good afternoon. It's Ian Kershaw calling from Calgary in Alberta, Canada on the afternoon of Wednesday, 25th of January. Just thoroughly enjoyed the show. The article by Alan Epstein, no relation to Brian, I don't suppose, regarding the geared turbofan was extremely interesting, so much so that I was listening to it on the way to work, and I got to the office where I was doing my first call. And I had to sit in the car for 10 minutes while I listened to the remainder of his contribution before I put things on pause and went to do some work. First class really added to my understanding of geared turbofans, and I look forward to going and having a look at the Pure Power site that Pratt & Whitney have put up. What an amazing company when you think that they've got engines still flying that they produced 50, 60 years ago, and they're at the leading edge today. And in the middle, we've got the PT-60s. What a company. Interesting, the Grill the Geeks article on the helicopter tracking. As soon as it came up, I said to myself, chalk on the blade tips, different colours, and a piece of wood in the air. Because if you just put grease on the wood, how do you know which blade? So my understanding is they put different coloured chalk on the tips of the rotors, and it works for two-bladed, three-bladed, four-bladed, and so on and so on. And you can track by the scuff marks, assuming you do it correctly, and introduce that rod carefully. So, yes, another great show. I enjoy all the content, interesting articles, as always, from all your contributors. And I want to say again to you all for your efforts. Thank you. I thoroughly look forward to my Wednesday's drive to work because I can listen to Airplane Geeks. And I was up at the airport this lunchtime for a few minutes. Saw another Twin Otter renovated by Ken Borat, ready to go to Ecuador. Isn't it interesting, how the aviation industry, not just airlines, but, you know, De Havilland Canada, made in Ontario, flown for 50 years, renovated in Calgary, shipped off to Ecuador. Meanwhile, in Calgary, Eagle Copters, Bell Helicopters, refurbished, shipped to Australia. Amazing, isn't it? Once again, take care, guys, and thanks so much for all your efforts. I know that there's a lot of work goes into this. Bye now.
And you know, from his accent, no one would really know that Ian was from New York City. I mean, actually Jersey. But Ian, I know you do a great job of making, you know, of hiding that. So.
No, otherwise, we hadn't heard from... It's been a while since the last Ian voicemail we got.
Yeah, yeah, and he also in an email sent along a link to the DC-3 network, which is interesting. He said this is a guy that he bought a DC-3. He gives private pilots a chance to get experience in the DC-3 from the left seat. Let's see, he says this guy rewrote the DC-3 technical manual and shares it freely on his website. Might be interesting to check out. That's www.thedc-3network.com. So thanks to Ian for sending that along too.
Do we have to send him another button?
I think he's got plenty of buttons.
Yeah, you know, I can just see this poor guy going to work at the office and he has all these buttons all over his jacket. They probably think he's kind of geeky.
Let's see. We also heard from Bruce. Bruce has got a question for Rob. He says, great job as always on episode 181. Many thanks for the hours of learning and entertainment we receive from you. He says, I have a question for Rob. Imagine a GA pilot plans to move from flying a piston aircraft, such as a Cirrus or a Bonanza, to a small jet. What will be the biggest challenges he or she will face in getting the new type rating? What are the biggest adjustments he or she will have to make? If you don't mind, please tell us how you made your transition from piston aircraft to jets. What was it like for you? Thanks very much for your willingness to talk about this. So, Rob, you got some thoughts on that?
He's assuming I'm willing to talk about this. I mean,
this is what we pay you to do, isn't it?
You know, I mean, okay, what the heck? It's an interesting question, actually, because what we find in training people out of, that come out of piston airplanes into jets is the one aspect that they never seemed to catch very quickly is the speed difference. Things happen much more quickly. We're often at a higher altitude in jets, and you have to plan a lot further out than you do in a piston engine airplane. So let me just give you a real quick example. I mean, most people learn to fly in a small single engine airplane, a Cessna or a Piper or a Diamond or something like that, and they're moving along at maybe 120 miles an hour, roughly, and they're down in the 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 foot category for their training. And when we would go out and train, of course, most places don't even train in the real airplane anymore. But I mean, I remember when we were still doing that, we'd go out and get a block of airspace in the center and go up to, you know, 18, 20, 22,000 feet and do our air work. We would do the stall series just like we did in a little airplane. We'd do slow flight. We'd do steep turns and configuration changes so that the pilot could get a feel for what was going on. But again, so that part is very similar to what you do in a small airplane. But when it comes time for the landing, if you're 100 miles out and you're at 35,000 feet, you have to figure out how soon do I need to start down? Because even if you're coming down at 2,000-3,000 feet a minute, you're also going forward at probably 6 or 7 miles a minute, and the math becomes a little more complicated. So that, of course, with all the new avionics, that calculation has also gone away because now the avionics tell you when to start down. But in the old days, it was a little more math focused. You could be really challenged. And again, what we often find is that the transition is really just people not being able to keep up with the speed at which things are happening in a jet airplane. Doesn't mean they can't catch on. Most of them pretty much do. But it's that transition in terms of thinking that the airplane's moving at 3 or 4 times the speed that they're used to that does take time.
All right, Rob, thanks for that.
Oh, and by the way, the simple answer to how did I make the transition, I got paid for it. I went to work for a company that needed a co-pilot, and I had some turbine time because I'd been flying turboprops, but I had never flown a jet. And they said, hey, kid, you want to fly a jet? And I went, okay.
And that was it.
And that was, did some ground school, went out and got checked out in the right seat, and then flew along for a while before they let me drive myself.
Great. Next email came from Michael. He says, in episode 172, during the story on Southwest's new slim seats, Dan was talking about seat pitch versus his laptop. He says it reminded me of an event I witnessed a few years ago. In the first class of a Northwest flight, a gentleman across the aisle got out his brand new shiny laptop, opened it up, and got to work. You guessed it, the passenger in the seat ahead of him reclined his seat and, crack, bent the screen and snapped the hinges on the laptop. The laptop owner yelled and screamed and turned red for a while before closing what remained of the lid and dumping the parts into his bag. It was very early in the flight, and the atmosphere in first class was pretty gloomy for the next couple of hours. Ever since that day, I've been paranoid about it happening to me. I hope the new slim seats, or any new airline seats, will get rid of the sharp angle where the tray recesses into the back of the seat, as well as the tray latch, and make a smoother back with nothing to catch laptop screens. Maybe there should be a recording attached to the recline button that plays a message, something like, dude, this is a full flight. Is this really the kind of jerk you want to be? And he closes, keep up the good work. So thanks, Michael, for the story.
Yeah, I've had seats go back on my laptop a couple of times, but fortunately it's never happened to me. But that's kind of one reason I like using my iPad on flights now, because it's in my lap and it's smaller.
Yeah.
Dan, tell me something. When you're sitting on an airplane flight and you have the iPad in your lap and the flight attendant comes by and tries to give you or the person next to you something to drink, Do you pick your iPad up when they hand the drink across to somebody else? Well, I guess what I was thinking though is that do you mind them passing something liquid over the top of your iPad and if they drop it, I mean it's all over, right?
No, I'm not too worried about it. I mean, sometimes if it's drink service anyway, I'll put like the iPad away. But also the other thing that's really cool, if it's my laptop, the ThinkPad I have, if someone drops, spills something on it, it actually has a drain. So anything that's spilled on it goes right through.
Now, Stuart writes in, "Hello, geeks. I just listened to episode 182 and have a comment about disclosing fees." Yeah, we've had a couple of conversations on this topic. He says, the reason that I want to know what the fees are is because they are highly variable. For example, different airports have different passenger fees, taxes, landing fees, etc. Yes, some of the fees will be the same, such as the TSA fee, sales tax, but I would like a bottom line number of what I need to pay. For example, if the fare to Chicago is $20 less than the fare to Midway, but the, quote, make the tourist pay fee is $50, I might want to pay the higher airfare but the lower total costs and go to the other airport. He says, to go back to the restaurant analogy, I would want a restaurant to disclose sit-by-the-window fee, the auto tip for parties of six or more, sitting in the non-smoking section fee, etc.
I don't think the rule is necessarily terrible, and I get where it's coming from, all transparency, but I feel in this scenario, and I actually got some tweets about this, that in some cases, I feel, you know, the airlines are getting singled out a bit. Granted, there are some major exceptions like gas prices, but, you know, the policy for years and years and years and years and years has just been, you know, the airlines could exclude some government taxes and fees from advertised fares. And now we've just seen this complete 360. Well, no, actually not a 360, because that would be the same. This complete 180. I remember geometry not very well. and you know, we've seen airlines have to make these changes that have, at least from what Southwest has alleged, in government filings that would cause millions and millions of dollars. So that kind of I'm not the biggest fan of, but there are other parts. And what I think really is the big point of confusion for a lot of passengers is not really the government taxes and fees. Granted, they're there, but in comparison to things like bag fees round trip, not as huge. I actually went through some pieces of the rule today, and I think the rule helps there in some areas. So, for example, to quote directly from the final rule, if a U.S. or foreign air carrier has a website marketed to U.S. consumers where it advertises or sells air transportation, the carrier must prominently disclose on its website information on fees for all optional services that are available to a passenger purchasing air transportation. Such disclosure must be clear, with a conspicuous link from the carrier's homepage directly to a page or a place on a page where all such optional services and related fees are disclosed. So, you know, that I'm cool with that, because I think the airline should be very clear about fees for bags or food or standby or what have you. And just putting up a page, you know, putting up an additional page on a carrier's website isn't really that hard. Whereas with the government taxes fees, I feel it's more complex, where I think the biggest confusion for passengers is on the ancillary side. But I can certainly, I don't know, maybe I've mellowed a bit over the past couple of weeks.
Ancillary?
Yeah, in terms of, I think more confusion for passengers personally is how much I'm going to pay for a bag, or how much am I going to pay if I want priority boarding, or what have you. I think that's really been the biggest issue for consumers, as opposed to the government taxes and fees. Personally, I was fine with the old rules. I still think I was fine as long as the carrier told you before you hit buy, here's everything what you're paying. But granted, the rule just came into effect, so kind of water under the bridge at this point. So,
yeah. But what was Mary's point when she was on last week, a couple of weeks ago? Remember, we were having this discussion, and she was very much in favor of the consumers being given all the facts up front, because I believe her point was that the consumers don't know near as much about this as we do, and that there are an awful lot of things that might slip through the cracks.
Which is true, and I'd have to go back, because I don't want to misquote Mary, but I think she mentioned Spirit, and granted, Spirit has a boatload of fees that you can pay for depending on what options you want, and the rule addresses that in terms of there needs to be a link on the homepage to show all the fees, which is fine, whereas what's changing for advertising is solely government taxes and fees that have been historically excluded, like the September 11th security fee of $250 each way. So the advertising rule really has nothing to do with ancillary fees, where I think that's causing the most confusion for people.
Okay.
I think we have finally beat this topic to death.
Okay, I think that'll do it for this episode. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. And we'd like to apologize for the fact that we were unable to get connected with our planned guest this week, but we'll look to reschedule her and get her on in the future. We'd like to thank our contributors, Steve Fisher and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, and also Peter Johnson from alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. First, we'll start with David Vanderhoof. David, where do folks find you?
You can find me on Google+. You can find me on Twitter at DMVanderhoof, or you can check out my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
And Rob Mark, where do folks find you?
Well, they're soon going to find us on the upgraded version of Facebook, which is going to Timeline, I think, David. Is that what they're going to call it when they switch us all over?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll be on Facebook in the Timeline function, whatever that is, and also at JetWine on Twitter, and JetWine.com, of course, the blog.
Very good. And Dan Webb, where do folks find you?
You can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com, and I should give a shout-out. I am actually hosted by boardingarea.com, and there are a whole bunch of travel blogs that might strike your fancy. Or you can find me in the Twitter sphere at Dan Webbage.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. You can look for me on Google+ and Twitter as Max Flight, and also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode of the Airplane Geeks at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 183. That contains links to all the sites that we mentioned on the podcast, some other information, and usually some good photos that you might want to check out. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Bene Wilson will give us that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Bene. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Good night.
Bye.
Hot as hell. Beautiful and ruined.
Hey, he got it right for once. Hey, folks, greetings from hot Philadelphia.
Wow. And I've been practicing, too, so I don't know, so what? Sorry, I got nothing. I just didn't.
I like that. I hope that doesn't make it into the outtakes. That would be embarrassing.
That would be embarrassing.
Okay.
Everyone ready?
Yeah!
What has gotten into you tonight, Rob?
It's not same as every night.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me, sir. Have you been drinking this evening?
No, actually, no. I guess I'm just...
Maybe that's the problem.
Maybe I should have had a beer before I started.
Yeah.
Too much caffeine maybe today or something. So I'm ready to go to the news, Mr. Max.
All right, here we go.
Dan, you're different.
Well, it's very hard to... sorry.
They lit up hamburger. They lit...
I'll give it a crack. I'll probably screw it up, but, you know, that's me.
Yeah, well, you're an air traffic controller. You're allowed to screw it up.
I mean, the good thing about them is they are cheap as chips.
Yeah.
You know? Really are sort of cheap as chips.
crazy times. And nothing crazier than our London Mayor Boris Yeltsin wanting to put
Boris Johnson.
Boris Johnson.
That's definitely going in the end of year.
That one's in the blooper. About 13, 14 minutes, so got my work cut out on stripping that by 50%, but I think
I bet Boris Yeltsin's going to disappear, mate.
Yeah.
He's dead, isn't he?
What was I thinking? That will make the bloopers.
All right, finally, we received an email from Stuart. He says...
I'm sorry, Matt, where the hell is this echoing coming from? Because I keep hearing you echo.
Yeah, I know. I can hear me echoing, too. I don't know where it... I don't know where it's echoing.
Is anyone playing us over speakers instead of a headset?
No! No, I'm on mute, as always.
Actually, I'm on speakers. Let me fix that. Let's see if it fixes it.
Hey, yeah, that would do it.
God, we've been into this for like, what, 2.5 years now, Rob?
All right.
How's that?
That's much better. Step back a little farther, Rob.
Hey, how's that?
A little farther and that'll be good.
Hey, how's that?
Perfect.
Remind me at 3:30 a week from today that I have a podcast. Yes.
Here's your reminder for this Sunday at 3:30 p.m. Okay, I'll remind you.
Oh, this is so cool.
Technology.
I've only had the phone for about a week, so I'm still in the oh my god period.
Did you watch Big Bang Theory this week?
Yes. Okay. It was so good.
Who is your favorite airplane geek?
I don't know.
Oh, you have a 4S too?
Yeah.
Why don't you ask Siri, what is an airplane geek?
Here, let's do this. All right, let's see. What's an airplane geek?
Checking my sources. I don't know that. Would you like to search the web for it?
Oh, yes. Yes, please.
Searching the web for what's an airplane geek.
Actually, I wonder, because they do they have Wolfram Alpha in here.
It took us right to the page. It says Airplane Geeks Podcast, Aviation Podcast. AirplaneGeeks.com.
Let me see if they have this data in Wolfram Alpha. This would be cool. What is the cruise speed of a Boeing 747-400? And then I'll shut up after this.
Let me think. I found this for you.
Yes. Okay, it got it for the 747 SP, but that's so cool.
Okay, this is just really sick and disturbing.
Well, it's 240. Okay, though it does say it's 246,100 miles per hour.
Welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Tonight's guest, Siri.
Will Dan ever find love?
Sorry, I don't understand. Will Dan ever find love?
Oh, poor Dan. Well,
all right, I think it's time to call it a night, personally.